Test. Is that better? Can everyone hear me now? Okay, sorry. All right, so I'm Patrick Havisham. You might have seen me in some of the other sessions, but we're going to talk about how Microsoft IT, or MSIT, has really been enabling consumerization over the past 10 years. So it's interesting enough that this new word, consumerization, I'm not sure exactly who created it or invented it, not in the English dictionary or any dictionaries that I know of yet, but We've been able to do this for the last 10 years at Microsoft. When I first joined Microsoft, I was able to buy any machine pretty much on the planet and bring it in and get it connected to the network and get some level of access for the last 9 years. Okay? But it wasn't just like an instant on and everything just worked. So what we're going to talk about is how all the steps are from the networking layer through into access gateway, through management, through all these different pieces that we got enabled to do this. So like today, I could bring in any kind of device, I mean, a mobile device or a laptop, and based upon the device and how much we trust that device, we'll get you access. So maybe it might only be email, calendar, contacts. Maybe it might be access to SharePoint. Maybe it might be access to a line of business application. That's going to be dependent. So there's a lot of infrastructure pieces that have to go into play, and we're going to show a lot. So we're going to kind of keep this going, but we're going to show a lot, and you don't have to implement everything here. So this is going to be kind of overwhelming, all these different things. But at the end of this, you're going to say, oh, I want that, that, and that, and maybe that's all I need to enable consumerization of devices into my organization. So with that, we'll talk about the risks associated with bringing all these devices into my organization, Windows and non-Windows. And then we'll talk about each of the enabling technologies. Some of our are built into Microsoft products. Some of our built into or come from our partners as well. And at the end, I've got one slide that puts this all together to show you exactly how this works seamlessly. So how did we get there? You know, in the beginning, we had access to mainframes, dumb terminals. Then users needed access to applications, services, and then data center via PCs. And now users need access all the time from any device into personal, private clouds, business clouds. So this complexity is very difficult to face. So as we look at it, we're going to talk about questions that you might have as you start going there. Now, should every user have access to all corporate data? No, right? The HR person doesn't need to have access to the Windows source code repository. The finance person doesn't. But the HR person needs access to the HR, the CRM, and the salespeople need access to CRM. So bringing the concept of role-based access control becomes very critical. Now, should all computing devices, not just corporate computing, but all computing devices have access to corporate data? Well, no, right? Or maybe I've never thought about that. Thinking as devices as a new boundary, as a new security boundary needs to be brought in. And not just the device itself, but the operating system level on that device is going to play into this picture. What OS level? Now, should users have access to data independent of locations? No. Well, maybe, or I don't know. In fact, I was working with a Swiss company, and they have a rule that if the executive staff leaves Switzerland, financial institutions, their computer needs to have no corporate financial data on that device. So they looked at a scenario where they have a GPS built into all their devices, their laptops, and as soon as they leave the physical boundary, those data, the business data, gets wiped off that device. It's a little bit extreme, but this is this kind of concept that's happening around the world. So location is now another security boundary. Right? Should you grant access inside your network on your corporate wireless network? Maybe. Because I'm trusting that, I have certificates deployed. But as soon as that you leave and go home, should you have your mission critical data come follow you? Well, maybe not. Maybe I need to use remote desktop or VDI. So we'll talk about that. And is this a technology or policy issue and process? It's both. Right, you can have the best technology, you can have the best firewalls, the best security pieces laid out, but it's really going to be a lot educating your employees on how to effectively use this technology. How do they use their devices? And giving them and setting expectations. Right? We just can't have anyone bring in a... What if someone brought you a first-generation iPad that wasn't patched, didn't have 4.3 on there, had no device encryption? Should you put that on your corporate network and give them full access? Well, probably not. They need to personally take responsibility and update that to 4.3 and turn on device encryption and turn on the PIN code. Right? So these are the kind of things that we'll talk about. So this is kind of a laundry list that we're going to do it. And if you see on the left, these are some of the issues that you're facing today, right? Some devices, limited mobile access. How do I, have to buy 3G for the employee? Do the employee pay for it? Do I pay for it? How do I deploy device policies to all these different devices, right? Luckily, most of them follow the Exchange ActiveSync standards, so that's good. Should I control and manage each device? I don't know. Would you guys like it if you came to me, you bought your own, you know, whatever device you like, the device du jour, and say, I'm going to put a management agent on there, on your personal device? Who would like that? Who would like that if I forced you to have a management agent on your device? So these are some of the kind of things. But if I bought Slate du jour, handed it to you, corporate asset, and I say, I'm going to put a management agent on there, you're going to expect that. Right? So these are the kind of things you have to look at. And then as we get in, we'll talk about data classification. We'll talk about data leakage as well. So thinking about how many iPads are lost, or how many slates, or how many PCs are lost on a daily basis, right? There's a statistic from New York, right? Every 15 minutes, some kind of computing device is lost in a New York taxi cab, right? So think about what the corporate data is on that. How do I protect that? How do I run a compliancy report that says, yes, that device was encrypted in some way, shape, or form, and I'm not going to lose corporate data? And then we're going to talk about the network. And I'm actually going to whiteboard some things on my slate here about how do I look at the network as a new way of doing security on the network layer. Right? So a lot of you might have VLANs, and you have VLANs and only access to certain devices on VLAN. If you look at Microsoft as a worldwide company, 90,000 employees worldwide, hundreds of thousands of offices everywhere. If we went to VLANs, the complexity of trying to manage that network security was impossible. So we'll talk about a new way, and how we're doing it is through IPsec, server and domain isolation. And then at the end, we also want to talk a little bit about applications, the application boundary. We talked a little bit about that in some of our previous sessions, but we'll reiterate, maybe I don't push anything out to that device. Maybe I think about all these consumer devices as hostile. And I'm going to use application virtualization, or remote desktop, or remote applications as a boundary. So no corporate data ever going to one of those personal devices is another option as well. So on the right, these are the things that we've enabled. Pretty much, is everyone's got Exchange ActiveSync, right? Going out to all your devices. Right? So that's kind of the easiest thing, right? But you have to think about email. How many emails are flying around your organization today that have mission-critical, high business impact? So thinking about your CXO, your executive staffs, do you trust all the email that they send back and forth to be resilient on reside on an iPad, an Android device, on their own consumer device? Right? So it's an easy way to push out. I can then do device enforcement. I can say I at least have a PIN on there. So they have to at least put a PIN in there. And with 4.3 of iOS, you can do device encryption. With Android 3.0, you can do basic device encryption. Okay. Now, that's pretty easy. I can publish a port, 443, an SSL port out, and I can manage policy versus ActiveSync. So that's been at Microsoft for many, many years. So that's the easiest thing. But then we get into data classification. This is where it becomes interesting. Going back to that statement, I was a Windows source code developer in one time in my life here back at Microsoft, and I had access to a source code repository. And we classified that as high business impact, right? We don't allow developers to go necessarily access their source code from any kiosk in the world, but they need to be on a trusted, secured Windows 7 BitLocker-enabled device. And sometimes we'll only enable that through a remote desktop, so they have to come back into the corporation, go to a remote desktop, a Windows 7 running inside the corporate boundary, and then access and do their job. Now, the other classifications are medium. So we have things like our CRM databases, our some product information, so release product information. And we allow access to approved devices on that. Or if you're coming from a consumer device, we will look at maybe having a remote desktop instance or publishing terminal services as at the edge to then allow you to hop onto that box and then access that medium business impact. And then, of course, low business impact. We see here voice is low, video, some emails. But in any one of these places, there could be a high business impact version of that. Right? So going back to that email for... say we have a new build of some product, some secret product, right? We want to encrypt that email. So that's going to be a high business impact email. So it's going to be more the exception rather than the standard, or in any one of these cases. So what do we do about that? At Microsoft, we've had RMS deployed for a while. In fact, I've got an interesting story. We had a We had an email go out to a large number of people inside of a company, and that email had some generic information. And this is at Microsoft. And then somebody new at Microsoft replied all to an email at Microsoft. So imagine a reply all to about 60,000, you know, employees, and the reply was, "That's great," to an executive at Microsoft. And this, we've come to find out this was the employee's second day. He was a tester at Microsoft. He replied all, said, "That's great," to an executive. Okay? Well, so the worst part of it, the six other emails that came right after that were six employees that we figured out at Microsoft were, had been employed for about 7 years, replied all to his reply all, say, "We don't reply all at Microsoft." So within about 7 minutes, you know, 360,000 emails just flooded our exchange system. And this was before RMS. And we were actually, I was in IT at the time, and we were actually working on deploying RMS, the Service Pack 2 of XP. And we had about a 2 month, you know, we were about 2 months, we're going to release it. Well, we get a phone call from that exec. It's like, "You know that RMS thing you're doing? I want it tomorrow." So we stayed up a while. We didn't get it tomorrow. It took us about 2 weeks. But then, so now, every email has the option, and all the executives now use this nice option, is Microsoft Confidential, do not reply all. And that's their standard, right? And then we also had that low, medium, high business impact categorization. So anybody at Microsoft can now select any one of those confidentiality levels and encrypt that email. Okay? Well, next, SharePoint, right? We create a lot of documents inside of SharePoint. RMS has been enabled inside of SharePoint as well. So the first thing we do now, if you're a say he's a Microsoft employee, you create a SharePoint site, the first question you're asked, is this site going to contain low, medium, or high business impact data? And then automatically in the back, as soon as he checks, say he checks it's high, automatically every document that gets uploaded or downloaded from that document library inside of SharePoint will automatically get encrypted. So you've taken part of the ownership. This was a process and procedure. We had to explain to all the employees, you're now the owner of that data. You need to understand what these classifications level are, and now you are responsible for that. IT then automatically enables, so SharePoint automatically enables the encryption, the RMS, and the certificates, but it's his responsibility as the owner of that. So to do this, all you have to do is turn on rights management services inside of a Windows server. And we've integrated that into Active Directory. So basically what happens is I'm going out as an author using Office. I go out, I pull down, and I say I want to encrypt this document. Okay, I'm going to encrypt this document. Then I go back in, and there's a container around that application. We store the certificates into the SQL server. Then as a user, say I send it to Jeff, my colleague. He then gets it. He's already had granted access. Then he verified against the Active Directory RMS server, checks in SQL for the hash, and then allows him access. So no matter where that file goes, if he copies it to his hard drive, if he sends it out, we find out Jeff's a spy and he sends it out to a competitor, that content is encrypted no matter where it goes in the life cycle of that. Now, we have a partner that's released something that will help you out as well, GigaTrust. So they're an RMS partner of ours, and what basically they're doing is they've extended RMS to iOS, iPhone and iPad, BlackBerry, and they're working on Android. Right, so this concept of being able to then not just take the Windows devices, but if I have that executive that has the high business impact data, he can then go out and use this across multiple devices. So you're putting a high business impact boundary onto that untrusted device. Next, let's talk about encryption. From Microsoft perspective, we now have a standard inside of Microsoft IT that every machine that connects to the domain that wants to have direct access, and we'll talk about direct access in a little bit more detail, has to be encrypted. So all the machines, most everyone's machine in here, laptop-grade machine, has a TPM chip in it, right? So 1.2. With BitLocker and BitLocker2Go, we now have a group policy that says, as a Microsoft domain-joined asset, you will have encryption turned on. Now, some of the guidance that we learned, when we first deployed this inside of the Vista timeframe, we did it after the fact, right? So we deployed the Vista image, and then we tried to turn on BitLocker. So there was a lot of reboots. So one of the things from a planning perspective, as you look at deploying Windows 7, you can turn on device encryption or BitLocker in the image. So basically what you have to do, the kind of the gotchas that we found is that some of the TPMs aren't turned on by default. So you might get a machine, the TPM is off in the BIOS, right? So as an end user, not a lot of end users maybe know how to get into the BIOS and turn on the TPM, and they're called different things by different vendors sometimes. And then you have to turn it on and reboot. And then you have to go in and make sure it's initialized. And then depending upon which device, you might reboot four or five times. So from an end user experience, it's terrible. So what you do is you can work with the OEMs or make sure your IT department has that turned on and initialized. Then you, in the image, say that you're going to enable BitLocker. So now the process of, all, after you've done all that, you hand that device to your new employee, they will get a prompt saying, enter your PIN for your encryption. And it'll start encrypting as they go through the install process, right? As they name their computer, as they do that. And the encryption happens in the background. And that final reboot that you have when you finish installing Windows, that reboot does everything it needs in BitLocker to bring it up and running at the end as well. So 5, 6 reboots, 1 reboot. So think about deployment and enabling it at that. And then BitLocker to go. If you look at any of the USB sticks I have in my pocket, they're encrypted as well. So if I handed this to you, it would prompt you for a passcode to enable that. So it creates a small hidden partition on the device itself and then allows me to do device encryption at the USB level as well. And then, of course, there's also, you know, the other competitors out there are also doing encryption, but this needs to become kind of a standard. You need to enable and enforce device encryption no matter what device you have. Right? Some are better than others, and there's some third parties as well that do encryption. I know Good Software does some encryption across iPhone and iPad and Android as well. So that's something you need to look at from an IT perspective. Okay, so device encryption. Next, we want to talk about one of my... I think one of the best things that we've ever done. So I'm going to actually switch over to my machine over here. And we looked at, we actually had some auditors come to us and asked Microsoft IT, who has access to your source code information? Who has access to your finance information, HR? And we're like, oh, we've always had application level boundaries. But they said, no, who has access? And we said, okay, define access. And they defined access as at the networking layer, who can ping those repositories? We said, well, I mean, you know, anyone could ping the repository. It's a network layer. And they said, well, you need to lock it down at the networking layer. So we sat back, and this is about 5 or 6 years ago. Switching over to my tablet here. 5 or 6 years ago, and we said, okay, how do we do this? How do we take the existing technology? Because we had VLAN, just like I mentioned earlier. Let's see. Switching over. Is that it? 1, 2, okay, there we go. So we had technology, we had routers and stuff defined as, you know, we had boundaries for the source code developers, and they were in this particular VLAN, but then they started moving from building to building, so it became very difficult. So we decided to thinking about creating these zones. So we created what we call a protected zone. Even though it's a zone and there's a physical line, this is actually on the same contiguous networking space. Okay? Then we have, of course, we have the corporate network as well. And then, of course, we have the DMZ or extranet. And then, of course, the internet. Of course, we want to protect things like, you know, our HR data, our finance data. You know, of course, the Windows source code repository. Okay? And then, of course, we have all these machines that are sitting there residing in this corporate network. So this corporate and protected network are one constant physical networking space. Rather than creating the VLANs, we're like, how do we make sure that me, as a developer, so this is my machine, when I was a developer, has access to that? And then even more so, what happens if I do this? So me and a colleague of mine are sharing data across networks. So we thought about this. And what we came up with, this concept of IPsec. We all know IPsec. We think about that at the edge, encrypting tunnels and doing VPNs and SSL VPNs and things like that, or direct access. We said, there's an authentication piece of IPsec. So we started thinking about, can we use IPsec as authentication? So when you log into a Microsoft network, you automatically get 2 certificates in group policy. It's a master group policy against the entire corporation. It says, deploy a user, an 802.x509 IPsec certificate, user and machine, to every device. Okay? We're not encrypting. We're just using it for authentication. So now, there's a group policy in Active Directory says, do not talk to another machine unless these user machine certificates are on that machine. So what does that do? Let's think about that. Let's think about it. Microsoft is the second most attacked entity on the planet. Right? I think I mentioned that yesterday. United States Department of Defense is first. They say we don't want to win that one. But let's say someone, and they do this on a constant basis, brings in another machine and tries to war drive, right? To drive through our campus with some device and try to hack into our wireless networks. Okay? Well, they start trying to start pinging devices. Because this group policy was set, careful about what I switch over to. Yeah, be careful what I switch over to. All right. Let's see. Yeah. Damn tab. All right. Let's go new. Okay. All right. I'll have to redraw that real quickly. Protected. DMZ. Or actually, corp. Corp. Okay, so machine here has the user machine certificate. We have people that drive through our campus and try to ping everything. Well, because they don't have a user and machine certificate issued by our certificate authority inside from the Microsoft domain, then nothing's going to respond to them. Because it's looking for that. And currently, I don't think anyone's ever found a way to exploit both AD and the certificate authority and then log in and hack that and then get somehow a certificate delivered on a non-domain, non-trusted computer. But so this gave us a wireless security boundary. Okay, let's go back to that protected zone and that original request from the compliancy people. We said we had the HR, we had the finance, and then, of course, we had the source code repository. Now, interesting enough, HR controls our access strategy. Kind of sounds scary, right? HR controls our access strategy. HR has a tool. If you become a Windows source code developer, you get a background check, and they can do all this other stuff. And they go into their tool, and they say, yes, his new role is a source code developer. Okay? Well, they have a website that goes in and front ends AD, and then I get added into a group called WinDev. All right? So my user now is in this group. So I have two groups. And there's a machine group. To get in the machine group, you have to talk to the Windows security team and say, okay, I've been approved by HR to be a developer. Now I want these machines in this machine group. Right? So my user was here, my four machines, physical or virtual, it doesn't matter, got put into this. Now, I said that there's a domain isolation policy that says don't respond to anyone at the networking layer unless they have these user machine certificates. Now, on each one of these server isolation, this is not SIP voice, this is server isolation policy that says, in this case, only respond if that user is in this group and, so it's an and, is in this machine group. I was a Windows source code repository. I had access to it, right? When I changed my group and I'm now in the security team, in this new consumerization team, I still know the IP address of the source code repository, and I've checked this. I can't get to it. I can't ping those same things because HR moved my role. Therefore, I lost access to this. So my username got deleted out of this, and then the security team deleted my groups. So even if I wanted to, I couldn't access that. So now let's think about this. Let's think about this in terms of consumerization. So if you start bringing on unmanaged devices, and again, I don't care which one it is, right? So if I bring an iPad, right, or if I bring an Android device, or even if I bring a Windows 7, you know, phone or slate that I buy and I don't want to join it to the domain, because they're not joined to the domain, I'm never going to be able to get here. So I can now have a boundary, right? But maybe I'll publish Exchange Active Sync to those non, you know, trusted personal devices. So this allows me to have a protection. I can allow some of these other devices to come into my network and then control what computers or what gateways they get access to. So this is something that we set up about 7 years ago. And the interesting thing about it was that literally we have two people in the Active Directory group that manage this policy. They said it once. They said server and domain isolation. These are the machines, tied it to the Active Directory groups. This is the domain isolation policy. All computers at Microsoft have to adhere to that. And they haven't touched it since. And now, in Server 2008 and R2, there's actually a wizard. You can actually test deploy this. And it will actually test deploy certificates to all your machines in your network and give you a report back. And you can actually use that from a compliancy perspective, how many machines would pass this before you turn it on. And please, do not enforce now. Please test. Make sure you do the test, because this could be the worst virus you've ever deployed if you just don't make sure this is going to work. So there's this guided steps. They test first, test, or then deploy and, you know, enforce 2 weeks later, and then you can always have the enforce now. But that's like the big scary nuclear missile button that shuts everything down if you don't do it right. Okay. So that check. Server and domain isolation. Now, NAP came along after this. Now we then start looking at the health of these computers, right? The health of these devices. And so here with NAP, again, a domain-wide policy that says every Microsoft-owned asset is going to be checked. So basically what happens since XP Service Pack 2 or 3, Service Pack 3, and everything forward, so built into Vista, built into Windows 7, there's an agent on each desktop. And that agent reports the state of health. So you guys might be VPNing today into your corporations, and there's always that scan that comes down and checks for AV, checks for firewall, checks for patches. No more. With NAP, the state of the health is maintained by the device. So when I try to make a VPN request to Microsoft or a direct access request to Microsoft, my machine says, this is my state of, for us, forefront endpoint protection. But this works across most AV solutions. For us, FEP is at this level. I got patched yesterday. I scanned this day. My system center updates were all delivered and deployed after patch Tuesday. My firewall is on. I have these security policies. So instantaneously, it sends that statement of health to that. Now, the network policy server, or the new name for RADIUS, this is the new RADIUS name, network policy server, built into Server 2008 and new, now connects and says, this client says this is its state of health. Let's compare it to my master state. And now we have these policy servers, Windows and non-Windows, of course, that we're constantly feeding the master policy, saying, hey, we just got a patch. We just got a new antivirus signature. These are the new things. Make sure you stay current with this. It then sends it, compares it, and says, okay, in this case, let's say it's not compliant. Say you've been traveling, you've been unconnected for a while, you didn't get the latest AV update. Okay? Puts you in a quarantine network. It can either go into a VLAN or it can go into, there's a couple other different remediation restricted networks it creates. And then it says, wait, not just leaving you hanging out, it will then automatically remediate that. So it'll send you the updates that you need or the policies or whatever it may be. And then it refreshes the statement of health on the client. This is key, right? And this is all happening like this. It takes a little while to explain. But that statement of health now says, oh, hey, I have new updates. So any security state change on the device will refresh that statement of health. Okay? Now I've got the latest updates. I'm going to re-verify and then let that user on. And then you can control this. You can actually even say, if there was a manual step, you can actually pop up a UI that says, IT is saying you need to go do this, right? If they have to register something, you can even control that entire state. And this works on the Windows devices, or on the Microsoft AV solution, but also works with most of our major AV vendors out there as well. Okay, so check. That was added. Now we know that each of the managed devices are healthy as well when they come into the Microsoft network. Okay. Next, let's talk about access. Going back to my original diagram over here, now we got to the point where we had all these devices, and again, this is not a physical boundary, but we went back to this, we had all these consumer devices that needed access, or thought they needed access to Microsoft corporate data. So one of the things we looked at, and this is again the DMZ and the internet over here, one of the things we looked at is, whoops, okay, oh, that's what I did, okay. One of the things we looked at over here was controlling and putting all these devices and having some kind of access gateway here inside the Microsoft network. Okay, so as you bring in this, whatever iPad, Android, Windows 7 consumer device, having them go to a centralized access point that might have a SharePoint site published, that might have a remote desktop site published. And so all these now devices can come through an SSL connection through here. So Unified Access Gateway or Citrix Access Gateway is a partner of ours. And now from an IT perspective, I can understand. I've enabled them on the wireless network, right? So you can either do that through certificates or not. But then they come into this central gateway, and I could publish certain line of business apps or certain portals through an SSL connection to that device. So therefore, that device, that untrusted device, is not going to actually pull any information down and be resilient on, or resident on that as well. Now the other thing is, as we talked about, location becomes interesting. So Citrix Access Gateway or UAG, having another instance at the edge of your network. Okay, right. So we talked about maybe at the edge of your network, I only publish Exchange and maybe a low business impact SharePoint site or a remote desktop. Maybe, or I don't do remote desktop at the edge and only I do it on my wireless network. All right. So this becomes that decision point for your business. How much risk are you willing to accept on that non-managed, non-Windows or non-managed device, non-managed consumer device? So that's the concept behind an access gateway strategy. And the benefits here, again, a single place to go. So now you're not just wondering where all these devices are on your network and what they're accessing. And now you can run a report. And you can run a compliancy report. So if you're in an industry or vertical that needs, you know, you're a finance or government, that you need to be able to report on exactly what's happening on your network, an access gateway strategy becomes very effective as well. And Citrix as well has a solution called the Citrix Access Gateway, and they've even extended it. So you can actually front-end their Zen app, their Zen desktops, their Zen server, scale it out. Netscaler to help you scale out. And they even have branch repeating. So if you have a lot of sites, you can then start caching data out to these remote users, and they're not coming across your main network connection as well. And the other interesting thing about Citrix's solution is they have an iReceiver. For the iPad, they have a Android receiver. So basically, it's an agent that resides on these Android and iOS platforms that allows and kind of front ends the remote application experience. All right, so that's a free download, but you have to have all the licenses on the back end. But that gives you a better touch experience. So now I can actually run Word, PowerPoint, Excel on an iPad, on an Android device, right, very effectively, and it makes. Rather than remote desktoping in, it actually publishes that application right to the device. And it gives you the capability actually to kind of interrogate that device. And going back to that previous statement, I said you want to make sure that that iOS is on the latest release, that Android's on the latest release, even or that Windows 7 slate may be on the latest release. That iReceiver can kind of check the state of the device. Okay, gateway strategy, check. Now, let's talk about remote desktop as well. Another possible, and Microsoft has enabled every one of these, but I don't use every one every day, right? These are the things. These are all the possible scenarios that we can enable inside of Microsoft IT, and some work better in some spaces. But let's say I'm at a kiosk somewhere in the world, right? So I'm going down to the hotel because my battery's dead because I've been using it all day long, or I'm at the airport. With this, we have a cross SSL connection. I can access a terminal server gateway instance at the edge of Microsoft, right? And I don't have to be an admin on that machine for this to work. So I can log in separate contacts. I'm actually doing screen scraping across that. So I can actually go in, get to my Outlook. I can go to Outlook Web Access if I wanted to. I can go into a terminal server connection that's sitting back at my desk in Redmond right now and do remote and use that device that's inside the corporate network, do my work, and nothing comes back down to that terminal or that kiosk that I'm residing upon. And so this gives me the options. And the other thing is, so if you look at, you know, let's quickly talk about that scenario, is if I look at, as a Microsoft employee, right, my options are, so I pull out my phone first. Well, on my phone, I can get a lot of stuff, right? I can get email, calendar, contacts. I can get SharePoint on this. Say my phone dies because I'm using it on the plane the entire time. I can pull out my laptop. My laptop has a TPM chip. I can do full direct access, and we'll talk exactly what that is in a second. But if not, say I need one of yours, and say, can I borrow your laptop real quick? I can go take your laptop, do a remote desktop, or I can do a terminal server gateway. So I have many ways to possibly get at data, right? So the most secure for us is going to be that TPM-protected, BitLocker-hardened Windows 7 device. And there I'm going to have the most access, but I'm going to have granular levels of service depending upon what device, right? Or if I pick up the iPad, I can still get to an Outlook web access portal, right? If I don't have RMS on there, maybe I can't get to the RMS protected because it's your iPad or whatever. But if it was my iPad, then I could put the RMS agent from GigaTrust on there and I can get to that high business impact. So these are all the kind of decisions you have to look at as you're making these determinations. Okay, so now let's talk about direct access. How many of you have using direct access or heard or going to use direct access? Okay, so for those of you that haven't used this, imagine going anywhere in the world, and this worked. I've been doing this at the hotel this whole time. Imagine going anywhere in the world with an internet connection. So you either have a 3G connection or you get onto the wireless network and you open up your laptop. And as soon as you open up your laptop and you start typing in, like maybe your SharePoint site, your internal SharePoint site, you start typing that in a browser and no VPN is needed. And instantly, that SharePoint site comes up on your machine after you've got onto the internet. That's direct access. That's the usability of direct access. Now, being a security guy, you know, when they first came to me, I was like, you're crazy. You just told me that I opened up a machine, logged onto the internet, and I'm fully inside of the Microsoft domain on the corporate network. Now, here's the interesting thing, though. Before that happens, in the background, right, as soon as I log into my machine, if I rebooted my machine, the first thing that happens is, remember, I enabled BitLocker, so it's mandatory. So first thing that would have happened is I would have been prompted for my PIN code to get into BitLocker. So even starting the machine up, PIN code. Okay, so BitLocker's turned on. Next, once I get into Windows, I could then do enforce multi-factor. So I could even enforce a smart card to be my primary login if I wanted to, but we still use username and password. So I use username and password, I get in. Now, as that initial request is going back to the SharePoint site, back inside of Microsoft, it's actually making an IPv6 IPsec encrypted connection back to our UAG. So UAG is sitting at the edge of our network, and it's scaling out direct access. Direct access is a feature of Windows Server 2008. Right? You turn this on, UAG scales it out. That UAG server says, wait, before I trust you, I'm going to check the NAP state, the network access protection state. It's going to say, is your AV up to date? Did you get your latest system center patches? Is the firewall on? Is your group policy, all that up to date? So NAP says yes. If I have to be quarantined, it'll fix it. If NAP says yes, then it allows me on. And we added a new feature that's coming inside of System Center that allows us to do, putting certificates down into the TPM chip as well. So we can do many different ways of multi-factor authentication. So that was actually about 4 or 5 factors of authentication that happened before I established that IPv6 IPsec encrypted tunnel. But the end user experience was going back to what I said. I open up my machine. After I get through BitLocker and everything else, I get onto the hotel wireless network, pay the $30 or whatever it is for 24 hours, and then I start working like I am sitting back at Redmond. Internal URL, internal access. No VPN, no waiting, no scanning, none of that. Just instantaneous access back to your corporation. Now, let's think about another side benefit that came out of this. As soon as I go home at night, right? Say I don't want a VPN in, but I still want to use my machine because it's consumerization of IT, right? I'm going to surf websites, I'm going to do all this other stuff. I open that up, start surfing some websites. It, in the background, connects back to Redmond. I don't even know. It's just happening. IT now has a channel to manage me. Anyone like Patch Tuesday or even worse, Patch Wednesday, the day after? So think about this, though. If that machine's connected, and you set up a Patch Tuesday to issue to all your machines at like 1 a.m. in the morning, patches come down because they're direct accessed in. Patches come down and say you do need a reboot, okay? That never happens, right? Anyway, so you do need a reboot. It reboots in the middle of the night. So in the morning, you're not waiting for all these patches to deploy. In the morning, it's just rebooted. You control, delete, log in, you're done. That's cool. I don't have to worry about it. IT now controls it, can do inventory, can do patching 24 hours a day, wherever it is in the world, and you're not waiting for that patch Wednesday, the day after kind of side effect. So that's Cree from a direct access perspective. Now, check. What about those, remember we went back to the scenario of the applications, or management. So we said this in the other one, I was going to reiterate if you missed the other session, but at latest Microsoft Management Summit, we announced that System Center Configuration Manager 2012 will have the added feature of having mobile device management. Right, going back to my use case scenario, so if you didn't hear that, I have 50 devices that connect to the Microsoft corporate network through Exchange. They love me. But now, if someone mugs me and steals my backpack of 10 devices right now, they'll go in and see Patrick Hevesy. My HP 2740 EliteBook has BitLocker turned on. Check. My Windows 7 Slate, BitLocker. Check. My Phone 7, remote wipe it. My iPad 2, remote wipe it. And then they can run a single consolidated report of all these devices that Patrick Hevesy owns. And MSIT doesn't have to scramble and launch multiple systems and trying to figure out what Patrick is really doing. So unifying the management. And this is light management. We have a partner of ours called Odyssey Software. So if you need a little bit more than just the Exchange, ActiveSync, Light Management inside of Config Manager, Odyssey extends Config Manager. So they have some agents that reside on some of these non-Windows devices and allow you to actually remote view of what's going on that platform as well. So it does a little bit more hardware inventory. But there's an agent. So there's that agent piece. So if you're okay with an agent, you can look at a partner like Odyssey Software. Now, the other piece is looking at this concept of cloud management, right? So, and there's a product called Intune, and Intune is really looking at non-domain join PCs, really going to giving your employees, $2,500 New Zealand dollars and say, go buy a laptop, right? I necessarily don't want to join that to the domain, right? So with Intune, it will download an agent on that device and allow you to do some basic management. Is there an antivirus on there? Is it patched? Is it all these other things and allow you to do some control and run reports. And this is great, especially if you're doing a lot of acquisitions or mergers, or if you have a contracting staff, right? Again, you're not going to want to go buy all the contractors a corporate-owned asset. This allows you to still have some granular level of control and understanding of what's connecting to your network through a cloud-based service. So definitely check out Intune if that's part of your scenario. Now, from an application deployment perspective, you know, Jeff's whole session, I mean, talked about this concept, remote desktop, remote applications, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but you know, imagine you as an employee going to any device on the planet and having your desktop, having your remote apps just show up on there, right? It could be through a remote desktop, it could be to terminal services, it could be to a thick client, a thin client, a kiosk. So the concept of having virtualized applications being delivered based upon your role in the device becomes an option as well. And in this case, you can actually say these are containers. These are application-level containers. And if you embed that, say, into a terminal server, I can. There's tons of apps out there on the iPad, on the Android slates that allow you to do remote desktop with terminal services. So, you know, some are paid, some are free. You go out and then have an edge device and then have your apps virtualized in the background inside of Configuration Manager. And when I log into that terminal server instance, it knows, oh, it's Patrick Hevesy. This is his role, deliver Office to there. And it's never coming down to the iPad, but I'm actually using the whole suite of Office through that remote desktop or that terminal server connection on this unmanaged, untrusted device. And when I'm done, that terminal server, that remote desktop says, do not allow copy-paste, don't allow downloads. So I'm protecting that corporate data. And then I go back and say, I go back to my Windows 7 device, all that data, since I have App B across Active Directory, all those things. I can even take my documents file and replicate that up into the corporation so I can do work on that unmanaged consumer device, save a PowerPoint document, come to my Windows 7 slate, and it's right there replicated to my machine as well. Very powerful. Okay. A lot of these things. I mean, but these are the things we've been doing over the last 10 years. And this is why I can literally take any device, come into Microsoft. Now, depending on that device, I'll get more or less access. Right? On the iPad, I'll get email, calendar, contacts. To get to SharePoint, I need to go to remote desktop on an iPad. If I take a Samsung Series 9 laptop that I buy with my own money, and bring it in, I can then join it to the domain because it has a TPM chip and BitLocker then come on, and then I can make full direct access an option for that. But if it doesn't have the TPM, MSIT says you're not going to get direct access, right? So these are kind of the decisions that we've made. Now, quickly kind of putting this together, we showed this, and I want to just reiterate this. If you didn't see this, this is kind of the matrix as you're going to have to determine where you're going to put that device. How much do you trust that device? Is there a business need for you to enable the iPad, a business need for you to enable the Android, you know, BlackBerry, whatever that case may be, a consumer device, or even the Windows 7 slates? And then you're going to have to determine, where am I going to put those devices? Pretty much everyone's going to allow email, calendar, contacts to most devices. Well, do I need high business impact? Is there that critical emails that are flowing through my system? Maybe you need to go get GigaTrust or RMS and start thinking about that kind of solution. Well, SharePoint, do I have access to that? Or do I have some kind of cloud-based storage for documents? But then how do I manage those documents if they're not in my private cloud? Or do I allow that? And that's a huge policy thing you have to make. We've seen a lot of customers where people are using things like Dropbox, SkyDrive, and all this other stuff to take corporate documents and put them up there. Does everyone trust Dropbox in the room? Does everyone trust all these, you know, these cloud storage providers? How do you know for sure? Right, so this is kind of the thing. But if it was an RMS protected file and then they put it to cloud or you know to SkyDrive or Dropbox or whatever, at least you have that extra level of protection. You know that that file is not going to, if it gets lost somehow or someone finds a way around a cloud storage. And then finally, the line of business apps. Do I publish those through an App V or remote desktop or remote application? Because then you don't have to worry about them. And you're not going to have to go write a new app in an iOS or an Android or a Silverlight. You can just take the line of business apps you have today that your employees are used to using and pushing those out and putting a security boundary at the edge of that. Okay, so let's put all this stuff together. Here's how it looks, and it's going to be kind of a quick thing. Make sure we end on time. We got more than 10 minutes, right? Yeah. Okay, In the beginning, that end user, right? Corporate managed machines, they're all a whole bunch of wires running around your network. But it was really easy back then because people didn't bring in consumer devices. And we started doing data classification, started understanding. And then one of the big things we did was really start adding the concept of roles. So we took the Active Directory infrastructure at Microsoft. It was very, at one point in time, it kind of got a little bit out of hand. So we went back in and did kind of a health check of AD and said, okay, let's start thinking about how do we define groups, right? As a Windows developer, there's a Windows developer group. As a salesperson, there's a group. As an HR person, we looked at the top business divisions at Microsoft and said, okay, here are the major groups inside of Microsoft. And we're going to have group policies that affect everyone at Microsoft, and then we're going to have group policies that affect those divisions. We might have a group policy that affects you as, say, you're a salesperson, you're an account manager, you're a technical specialist, you're a solution specialist. You might have different policies. So we really looked at how do I define the entire company. Sometimes it may be their geographical concerns as well, so power supply or power saver settings that happen in certain countries. So we do geography, and then we do business division, and then we do roles. So now I can start thinking about group policy at each one of those levels. And then classifying the data and who has access to what types of data. Well, then a whole bunch of unmanaged devices. People are bringing network device, bringing devices in or buying devices and not joining them to the domain. So this is interesting if you've ever been on the networking side, security side. And then the other thing that happened right at this time was a whole bunch of people were bringing wireless access points that were starting to become really cheap and plugging them into the corporate network and then having, you know, wireless access hubs running around that weren't managed by Microsoft. We're like, what do we do about that? Well, the day we deployed server and domain isolation, I'm going to ask you, and you can't answer. The day we deployed server and domain isolation, I want to hear, how many computers do you guys think joined the domain that day inside of Microsoft? Take a wild guess. How many computers? So we had 70,000 employees at that time. How many computers do you think joined the domain the day we enforced those certificates? How much? Higher. Higher. Between the 45,000 physical and virtual machines joined the domain that day. We're like, where in the hell are these machines? We had no idea. This is not what we were thinking. We were thinking, oh, you know, there'll be 1,000, something like that. 45,000. That was crazy. And we're just seeing the Active Directory joins happening, and the system center's patching, and everything's going crazy. And the AV signatures are flying out. And we're like, oh, my God, who doesn't create the network? But the cooler statistic is, how many help desk phone calls do you think we got that day about this? Two. Whoever said two. It was two. Because think about it. It was a group policy that said, all you have to do is join the domain. And then it got patched, then it got managed, then it got secured. The certificates got seamlessly delivered in the background. And we had a full inventory of all the machines that were on the corporate network after that. We turned that policy on 7 years ago, once, we're done. And now it just works. Huge piece. Okay, so now that we got that, then we said, well, okay, high business impact. Maybe they're not fully managed. And there's some business exceptions why you might not join the domain. Very few, but there are some. But for those unmanaged devices, we need to give them away in case they were testing. Maybe they were testing a consumer non-domain joined scenario. Okay? Then we started turning on remote desktop inside of Microsoft. So then having a remote desktop sitting on the internal network, publishing that to the entire company through a SharePoint portal, say, hey, you can use this. Shared infrastructure, you can use this. Then you log into a Windows 7, or back then it was XP, I think. But you log into a Windows 7 instance, and then from there's an IPsec certificate, and then you can actually start going anywhere you want that your role has access to. That becomes critical. Your role has access to. Okay. Next. All these devices popped up, right? iPad, Android, you know, the short-lived HP WebOS, BlackBerry, I mean, all this stuff. And we got kind of back to where we were before. It's like, wait, all these unmanaged devices, but we'd already been publishing Exchange ActiveSync. We're like, oh my God, who owns this? Using different usernames, it was getting insane. We're trying to figure out what's going on now. So they're accessing this, so we said, okay, stop. We turned on Citrix Access Gateway, Unified Access Gateway, or Citrix Access Gateway, and we gave them, that's the point you go to with these unmanaged devices. And then now we really start running those reports. And now with the System Center Configuration Manager, Mobile Device Manager support, I can now manage those as well. So we've kind of pushed that we're going to manage and control access. We did both, an and. You could do an or. You could say access only or management. We did and. Okay. Next, we put one at the outside of the firewall as well. So this was internal, right? So we can now control internal. Or is if you guys came to Microsoft, came to our executive briefing center, we're going to put you on the network. But because you don't have those user and machine certificates, all you're going to get is access through the firewall, through our TMG firewall, and go out to the internet. So if you, I would even tell you the IP address is to go try and ping, but you'd take your machine and start pinging, and it would fail. So we put a UAG box at the edge of the network as well, and we publish different solutions internally as well as externally. Right, so we have Mac developers. We write Office for Mac, right? We have Mac, and they bring their Mac machines, and they connect to a UAG box, and then they can actually go and do things, get to a remote desktop, or they can run Parallels and run a Windows 7 instance, right? So there's all these different options that you can look at. But this allows me to centralize all the reporting, all the access piece. And then, say something goes wrong, right? Like the Android thing that we talked about. Where there's a new virus that came out by one of the application authors, and he created a botnet out of that. Well, maybe we say, until that gets fixed, you block that. Just, you know, until they fix that security hole. Or, you know, any one of the devices, right? If, you know, Windows, non-Windows, if there's some kind of security hole, I can then say, stop that device temporarily until there's some kind of fix before I let that device back onto my network. And then, with direct access being part of UAG, I can even then see my corporate managed corporate assets through this single portal as well. So now think about that. I have an access portal that shows managed and unmanaged devices using SQL reporting services, and I can actually start running compliancy reports and access reports on what's accessing my network from the outside as well. So that's how it looks all together. Took us a while, but this enables how I can literally bring in any device from any manufacturer on the planet, any operating system, and bring this in. Now, just the final piece that I want to talk about, I kind of skipped over on the previous slide, is back here, you know, I just want to reiterate that, you know, the identity piece has to be put into this as well. On the unmanaged, non-corporate assets, these consumer devices, you really need to start thinking about username and password is not enough anymore, right? You need to start thinking about device type. Who, you know, from an Android perspective, there's a lot of different devices. HTC makes some things different than the others, and they have different versions of the operating system. And you have to start looking at, and it's a full-time job. We actually have people dedicated to looking at every device on the planet today and what operating system level is on each one of those manufacturers, and then seeing, oh, maybe we need to enforce that if an Android device needs to connect to Exchange infrastructure, it has to have 2.3 or 3.0 for a slate. For an iOS, it has to have 4.3 because of device encryption. So this is part of the things that from an IT perspective you have to understand and think about. Is it worth that? Do I need to really? Or do I say these are the only manufacturers and only OS levels I support as well? But then the location has to come into play. What kind of access do I allow on my corporate wireless network, and what do I allow off my corporate wireless network? Right? So if I can deploy certificates and harden at least that connection, maybe I'll give them a little bit more access. Maybe I'll give them that remote desktop. Maybe I'll give them that line of business app or that remote app. But as soon as they go outside the boundary, they're at the airport, I'm just going to give them some email calendar contacts. So who you are, what device, what OS level the device is, and where you're coming from is kind of this new paradigm of how you have to look at for these unmanaged, possibly unsecured devices. This is how you're going to be able to protect your network, protect your corporate data from that. And so with that, it was a long process for us. And a lot of the things, as we stepped through that list, and it took us 10 years, but it took us 10 years to do that, but we weren't even thinking about consumerization of IT. There was none of these things happening at the time. But today, as you enable each one of these pieces, and you can pick and choose which ones you want. Maybe you want the access strategy. Maybe you want a management strategy. All these things have been turned into wizards. Like, when we deployed server and domain isolation, it literally took us 6 months because there was no standard, there was no papers on it. We kind of figured all this stuff out from scratch. But now, a great example is an IT guy can go in, run that wizard I was mentioning, and literally within 4 hours, you can get a report saying how many of your machines would actually pass compliance on server and domain isolation. Remember, no big red button, test only. But 4 hours. Run a script, it pushes it all out. There's another feature inside of Server 2008 called the File Server Resource Management Tool that allows you to actually go and look for types of data in your all your file repositories. And you go in and say, I want to find PII. So maybe I have credit cards or I have a government ID or some kind of thing that I know I need to protect. And it'll go out and scan all your file repositories, come back with a report and say, hey, here's all your high business impact in your network. And again, you could do that without doing any kind of implications. Right? You could take that and understand from a data classification where you're at. Then, from a networking thing, I think probably the most critical piece, I think the best pieces out of all that stuff was that server and domain isolation. Because literally now I can have any device, customer, non, you know, customer hacker coming into the Microsoft, you know, corporate network, and I'm still going to protect my HR repository, my source code repository, my finance from those non or those consumer non-managed devices. Okay. So with that, that's what we did. Now everything's a lot easier, and we have prescriptive guidance. The local team's been, you know, they've got services that can help you with this. And we're going to, Jeff and I are working on this, on trying to make that checklist a little bit more easy. So we're working on some tools as well that we're going to try to get published that will allow you to kind of go in and help you pick and choose and talk about the business reasons and what it's going to take you to implement each of those. But everything today is now, as soon as we figured all this stuff out, we've turned it into wizards, put it into the latest versions of the product to actually simplify this. So that's the end of the talk. We'll take questions. I hope, was this good? Does this help you guys? Kind of give you some a lot of ideas for thought? Okay. So thank you, and then we'll take questions. That's easy. Cool. A second. Yeah. Okay. So the question was, is there a particular order I would start with? Let's go back to the slide. Okay. I would say most people have Exchange ActiveSync, I would think. The low-hanging fruit for this list, I would say, the data encryption is pretty low. You can turn that on without any kind of dependencies for most things. It's a group policy. You can say for, you know, Windows. And for the non-Windows devices, you can use Exchange ActiveSync. RMS is an easy standalone too, right? So as long as you have Active Directory, you can even enable RMS, and you can tie it to SharePoint and Exchange pretty easily. Server domain isolation, I think, is probably the most critical. But it does take a little bit of planning, especially if you have a mixed environment. And there's some third-party partners of ours that are extending this to like Linux and Macs. Centrify is one of them. So if you have a lot of Linux and Mac, you need to go and talk to Centrify. They've got some extensions to IPsec management as well. But that's, I would say server and domain isolation is the most critical, but I would say there's probably a little bit more of the planning around that than the other ones. The other ones are easily turned on. And then NAP as well. And there's a partner called UNET Systems in Korea that extends NAP to Linux and Mac as well. So they're a certified partner of ours. And then the access gateway piece can be done without that. Now, the thing that needs a lot, has the most dependencies would be direct access. So if you're going to do something like direct access on a Windows 7 machine, you really strongly urge, this is a Microsoft recommendation, is making sure BitLocker is turned on, making sure server and domain isolation is your enforcement mechanism, IPsec. And then you would need NAP turned on. So that's how we've deployed it. Those are all the steps we need to deploy that. Right? You can turn it on with less, but that's, you know, you're taking your own risk. So that's how we're, is that good? Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there a white paper or a cookbook that you can pull out and say, if I want to in this organization, this is where I should be starting, this is what I should be doing?
So the question is there a white paper, is there a cookbook? Jeff and I are in the process right now. We literally just finished this whole deck, this concept of kind of recording everything that we've been doing over the last 10 years. We're trying to create some kind of tool, and we'll definitely take feedback on this, but we're kind of taking some tool where we ask some questions and then start saying, we recommend these out of that, and then these are the dependencies. So we're trying to figure out the best way to do that. So I don't know if a white paper is enough, but we're trying to find a tool that allow, and we can put this out on Microsoft.com. But so that's something we're working on right now, because we literally just finished this deck for our internal conference 2 weeks ago. And this kind of all came together. But we're going to work on that. And we'll make sure that the local sub has that as well as soon as we get it published. Probably about, I would say, we'll try to get it done by in next month. Nope. Yeah, no, I'm not going to touch that. Wait, sorry, I'll say it one more time, sorry. Yeah. You know, that's, yeah, so it's 802, it's not at the 802.1x, it's at the IPsec layer, so it's layer 3 across the entire network. But 802.1x adds a complexity. We could, but we don't. I mean, let me take that back. And a wireless thing, yes, we'll have 802.1x wireless, you know, certs, yes, and that for wireless, yes. But for NAP, so NAP can allow you to enforce both 802.1x, IPsec, DHCP, VPN, right? So DHCP is great for if you're a small company and you're not really using it as a security boundary, but and we can do 802.1x on a NAC solution as well as ours, so we can integrate the two. But we, for our enforcement of NAP, we only use IPsec. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, back there. Yeah, so the question is, we're using server isolation on our source code repository, HR, and our finance repository. How we do those on terminal services and the other ones. So there's a couple features of server and domain isolation that become interesting, especially if you have a non-Windows device that doesn't have the certificates and you still want to allow access to that. So there are machines that have exceptions. Now, one of the possibilities in server and domain isolation is that you could sit there and say, try to present your user and machine certificate, and if not, allow them. Don't block, but log that, and then allow them through. So we do that. So if we have machines that have to get to non, you know, IPsec protected machines, like maybe Macs and other things like that, we'll at least get a log saying that this machine, this MAC address, this IP address tried to access, and we get some basic information about it, and then we let them on to that. So that's kind of the way you kind of cross the boundary between if something doesn't support IPsec as a standard, and then you'd be able to get into terminal services. So there's those edge cases. In the server and domain, there is a server and domain isolation white paper that's out there today. You go to microsoft.com/NAP. There's a server and domain isolation and the NAP white paper that we helped write. And it talks about those boundary cases. How do I make sure that those don't enforce only, because then you'll not be able to get to it. Yeah. Now the remote desktops running on the RDS have user and machine certificates. So if I log into a remote desktop client on that RDS server, then my user certificate gets provisioned into that virtual machine, and then I have my access from there. So we don't have to go do anything special. It's just because, again, AD sees me, sees that virtual instance of Windows 7 is no different than a physical. Okay. All right. Anything else? Okay. Well, with that, I'll be up here for a few minutes. I hope this was a good session. Thank you for your time. Have a good rest of your day.